This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. On this week's show, we talk about the electromotive lockout in London, and after that, Doug will follow up with a review of David Camfield's latest book, Canadian Labor in Crisis.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
In Indiana, thousands of workers have demonstrated against the state legislature's attempts to pass a right-to-work law. Members of the steelworkers, carpenters, laborers, teamsters, food and commercial workers, and other unions rallied outside the House-Senate hearing on January 6th. The bill was approved by a majority Republican Senate Labor Committee. House Democrats responded by staying away from the State House last week, denying Republicans the quorum required to allow a vote on the bill. This strategy is similar to that used by Democrats in Wisconsin, who oppose attempts by Republican Governor Scott Walker to undermine the rights and benefits of public sector workers. Right-to-work laws are enforced in over 20 U.S. states, mostly in the southern and western regions of the country. These laws prohibit agreements between labor unions and employers that make membership and the payment of union dues compulsory.
As a protest against production speed-ups, a South Korean Hyundai motor worker set himself on fire on January 8th. The 44-year-old trade unionist, Shin Sung-hoon, remains in critical condition. Sung-hoon has made numerous requests to slow down production on the shop floor, but management refused. Other workers at the plant have collectively refused to work overtime. Adding to the injury, the company said it would seek damages caused by the union's actions. Since the incident, managers at the plant gave in to some of the demands and agreed to make a public apology. Several supervisors have also been reprimanded.
In the United States, the Communication Workers of America has led a campaign in support of Bill H.R. 3596, the U.S. Call Center Worker and Consumer Protection Act. Activists from the union's Legislative Political Action Committee team are distributing postcards that call on members of Congress to support the legislation. The CWA is following up on a victory it won with U.S. Airways in 2011 when the union negotiated the return of telephone reservation work from offshore facilities. Another 300 jobs were returned to the U.S. about 18 months earlier. Advocates of the bill also claim that the safety of personal consumer information is put at risk when call centers and other functions are sent offshore or outsourced. Canada has been a leading recipient of outsourced and offshored call center work coming from the United States. There is no indication yet what effect this legislation might have on the Canadian call center industry.
150 workers at a Foxconn factory in Wuhan, China, threatened to commit suicide in protest against working conditions at the facility. After 2 days, the workers were eventually brought down from the building's rooftop by managers and local Chinese Communist Party officials. The company has a dark history of suicides at its factories. In 2010, 18 workers threw themselves from the top of the building, resulting in 14 deaths. Rather than providing meaningful improvements to working conditions, pay, and benefits, Foxconn responded by installing safety nets around some of its facilities. Counselors were also hired to speak with workers. Foxconn manufactures hardware products for major multinational companies like Apple, Sony, Nintendo, and Hewlett-Packard.
The lockout of 700 electromotive diesel workers in London, Ontario, has entered its third week. The workers, members of CAW Local 27, are standing up against an employer demanding 50% wage cuts, an elimination of pensions, and slashing of benefits. Organized labor has responded with the CAW and Ontario Federation of Labor gearing up for a mass rally in London on January 21st. These concessions are being demanded by their employer, Caterpillar, despite the corporation's record profits and revenues in 2011. Coinciding with a lockout of steelworkers at Alma, Quebec's Rio Tinto aluminum smelter, and a looming municipal strike or lockout in Toronto, the London lockout is shaping up to be a major showdown for organized labor. Doug, you've recently written an unpublished article on the issue, and I want to ask you a few questions about what's going on. In the article, you talk about the political climate in Canada as a context for what's happening in London. Do you want to explain a bit more about this for our listeners?
Well, since the Tories were elected to a majority government in May, they've taken a hard line against organized labor, beginning with the postal workers' lockout in June, in which the government stepped in with back-to-work legislation, which included a pay increase that was actually lower than the final offer of Canada Post. Labor Minister Lisa Raitt also has twice threatened back-to-work legislation against Air Canada flight attendants, even though Air Canada is a privately owned company and not a Crown corporation. It was privatized back in 1988. And also in October, the labor minister suggested that the economy, that grand kind of abstract term itself, could be deemed an essential service, which would provide the government a pseudo-legal justification for back-to-work legislation, regardless of whether it was public or private sector. So really what we've seen in the first year, less than a year, of the Tory majority government is a very strong anti-union, anti-worker position, and it has really sent a signal to employers, as we're seeing with Caterpillar in London and Rio Tinto up in Quebec, that the government will intervene on the side of employers and also sit on the sidelines when employers are bullying workers.
For workers in Ontario and Canada, and I'd say more importantly for Canadians generally, this is obviously an important issue. Why then is the strike getting attention in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and even the mainstream media in Europe and Australia?
I think this, in part, at least with the local coverage, the enormous concessions being asked of the workers, a 50% wage cut, elimination of pensions, and a gutting of all sorts of benefits, that very demand, I think, in itself has a sensational quality that the newspapers will pick up. But also Caterpillar is one of the major, is a major player in the resource sector, is a long-standing and quite notorious anti-union employer, and what they do also makes headlines. In a certain sense, what's going on in London is the largest, most aggressive example going on in Canada at the moment in the private sector of an employer trying to smash a local union.
In the 1980s, we saw the crushing of the PATCO strike, the air traffic controller strike in the United States. In the UK, by Thatcher, the assault on the coal workers' union. Are we seeing a similar moment here in Canada where there's a crisis, there's a moment of crisis, and this is a pivotal moment not only for unions but workers?
That's a really great question. The PATCO and miner strikes in the U.S. and Britain, respectively, during the 80s were unions, were battles against unions that played a very strategic role in the functioning of the entire economy. No one can say that the 700 workers at the locomotive factory, EMD London, is somehow essential to the overall Canadian economy. So the importance, I think, of what's going on there is less actually about the power of a particular union in the economy and more about putting organized labor as a whole on notice as well as on the back foot by smashing a small but still quite powerful local union. CAW, the Auto Workers Union, is the largest and is the largest private sector union in Canada, and is also well known, like the postal workers, for a history of militancy. It is, after all, a union that was forged in the 1930s through factory occupations in Oshawa as well as Flint, Michigan. The struggle going on right now in London is as much about sending a political message to organized labor and workers in general that employers backed by the government, or just governments in general when they're the employer, will not, under any circumstances in the current climate, back the mass of the working population.
In the article, you talk about the international Occupy movement, the Arab Spring in Egypt and North Africa, and the picketing of Ryzen stores in the United States by CWA activists. What do you think has to happen in London and across Canada as a response?
Well, what has to happen is something that goes beyond the usual picket line, the usual mass rally where you bring in busloads of workers from across a province or across a country and have a huge symbolic show of force against an employer or government or whatever. And the Occupy movement and what happened in Egypt and elsewhere in Europe and around the world is that all this is leading to a point where the old means of protest and strikes are not sufficient to resist whatever's being done, in this case, the lockout at EMD. And not only are these movements confronting larger problems of corporate power and political corruption and so on and so forth, but they're also bringing forward and popularizing and proving the effectiveness of new sorts of tactics. Well, tactics that are not necessarily new, but have been used in decades. So the strike by Verizon that you mentioned, Verizon workers, last summer and fall in the United States saw activists across the U.S. picketing Verizon wireless stores in solidarity with the strike. And the Occupy movement has also put on the agenda the strength of occupying a location and using that occupation as a beacon of resistance well beyond that particular location. So really, the way we can translate this stuff to what's going on in London is we can start picketing the Caterpillar-owned Battlefield Equipment Rentals, which has over 30 locations in Ontario. We can start doing occupying the riding offices of Tory MPs across Canada, highlighting the corporate tax breaks that were given to EMD London, as well as the rest of industry. And we can also raise the demand or raise the idea of occupying EMD London, that the blood, sweat, and tears that have been put into those workplaces means that they are as much the property of the workers and of the community as they are some multinational corporation going around gobbling up whatever assets it wants to, regardless of who's working there, without their say. So really, the questions of occupations and spreading solidarity pickets across Canada and occupations of the offices of Tory MPs are the sorts of tactics that in the current climate, in the wake of the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, I think would strike a chord with thousands, if not millions of people across Canada and around the world, and really make London become a turning point for both organized labor and wider social movements seeking economic justice and restoring political democracy in this country.
Great. Thanks for the analysis, Doug. Well, that's all the time we have this week in the Rank and File Radio Labor News Update. Join us again next week for more analysis and coverage of the lockout in London. Up next, our interview with Jonathan Rose. Stay tuned.
The world needs steel, and we're the guys that makes it real good steel. You're never gonna break it, so keep those coke ovens blowing, those steel coils rolling, keeping that spirit alive. For the women and the men of the 1005, keeping that spirit alive. For the women and the men of the 1005. If you wanna build a bridge, you're gonna need steel. If they're marching off to war, you gotta be real about the steel. If you wanna build yourself a railroad that stretches from sea to sea, then steel's just the thing that you're gonna need. All the world needs steel, and we're the guys that makes it real good steel. You're never gonna break it, so keep those coke ovens blowing, those steel coils rolling. We're keeping that spirit alive for the women and the men of the 1005. Keeping that spirit alive for the women and the men of the 1005. The 1005, the 1005.
Our guest today is John Rose, PhD student at Queen's University and steward for the Department of Geography. John worked at Trent University for 6 years and was active in QP 3908, the union representing student academic workers and contract faculty. John, welcome to Rank and File Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself, where you're from, and why you became active in trade unions.
Well, I grew up down near Windsor, near Chatham area. And kind of grew up in a blue-collar, working-class family. So, you know, the idea of workers and working and the importance of labor and how hard it is and rough it is was always around me. So that's kind of where it starts. But I didn't really get involved in any unions until I did my undergrad at York, and the local there, QP3903, they kind of helped shape my perspective on union activism and how important and effective it is. And then once I got to Trent doing my MA, I just kind of felt like a natural progression to get involved in the local there and kind of get a sense of how to help workers out and how to create an environment where workers feel represented and feel respected by their employers.
Tell us a bit about QP3908, the Trent union that you're involved in, and what you did in the union.
Yeah, it's a union, like you said, that represents student academic workers. That's TAs and markers and contract faculty. I started in the union, it would have been back in 2006, and I started as a vice president, helping mobilize workers and sort of get people excited about the union. There was a period of rejuvenation because the union was kind of, part of the union anyway, was kind of dormant. And so there were a few of us who wanted to kind of rejuvenate it and get people involved and let people know about it. So I started off in that capacity, went through a couple of years of bargaining, sat on a couple of negotiating committees, and eventually became the president for a year, and then and I was the chief steward for a year. So held a few different positions there. It's a great union. It's kind of, there's a lot of young people that are really getting involved the last few years, kind of shaping it. It's only growing and growing. And so I just was really lucky to catch that union at a time in its life where it's really got a lot of momentum.
Trent is primarily an undergraduate university and has a reputation for political activism. What role did this play in shaping 3908 during your time there?
Yeah, Trent's really unique. It's kind of one of those universities that over the last probably 20 years has had this, or more actually, has had this reputation as of attracting people, students coming from high school who already have a sense of their politics, who already have a commitment to some kind of social justice. And so you see through the years these different actions that have happened that kind of demonstrate that Trent has this quality about it. How it helps, I think, is particularly with undergraduate involvement. So like when I went in as a grad student and as a worker there, the links that we made with the undergrad activist community the first couple of years I was involved were tremendous. There were a bunch of people there who are now still good friends of mine who are really involved. And, you know, they're involved with the newspaper, they're involved with OPERG, other social justice organizations. And those connections we made built a community. And that community, there were a couple of huge actions that we put together, you know, the unions and undergrad organizations that were really successful. And because Trent is small, there's an ability to have that cohesive link. But that the reputation, I think, is true. And there's still a good group of activists there now.
In early 2009, Carleton's TA union lost a strike vote. TA unionization here at Queens was defeated, and York's QP3903 was on strike for 3 months. But at the same time, 3908 won a strike vote and within a short period secured a new contract. What was different about the Trent case?
That's a damn good question. I think one of the things that made us able to have such a strong strike vote was the fact that it's a small university. And I know at that time when I was on the bargaining team with a good friend of mine, and we worked together with our local to try and, one of the things we did is, one, branch out to the members that weren't being contacted. So we had a divide, as we saw it, between hard sciences and social science and humanities. And one of the big things we did is we got a steward who was from the hard sciences. And the links that we made between these disciplines that there's kind of a this idea or this mythology that there's these breakages between these disciplines, but we found that the breakage was kind of a fallacy. It was a matter of just getting people together and talking and telling people what our issues were. And in a way, it was kind of shitty because we had to kind of tell people, listen, we're not York, we're not Carleton, we're Trent, and here's our issues, and here's our local issues, and let's talk about what this environment at Trent needs, and what do you want? And so that way we kind of had to distance ourselves, and I've got to admit that, because that was our strategy, and it worked. And for that point in time, it got more people involved, and more people mobilized and motivated. And so once people understood the issues, and once they understood what was at stake, and the importance of having a strong strike vote, they went with it, and thank goodness they did, because we got 3%, you know, increase in wages. We got a brand new professional development fund. We got some huge gains that year, and I think it was sort of because we shaped the issues as, what does Trent want? What do you need? And we made it a democratic process. We tried to bridge gaps, and we tried to bring people together.
So you've now moved to Kingston and you're attending university at Queen's. What are the major differences that you see between Peterborough and Trent with where you're living now?
Well, I haven't been here long, so it's probably premature for me to kind of comment on this, but I'll try. One of the things is just the unions. So I come from a CUPE background, Canadian Union of Public Employees. They work in a bit of a different way, I've seen, than the Public Service Alliance of Canada, the PSAC here. So I noticed kind of structural differences. They're, they're kind of largely small, but as I get more involved, I can kind of see more and more of those differences. Apart from that, I mean, the local here is new, and so I think that adds a different element. But the members here seem really excited and really... they're responding to the union really well, and I got to say, a lot of that has to do with the work that you and other exec members are doing to get out and communicate with members. When I was talking about Trent earlier and our involvement getting out and like talking to people on the ground, I think you've had a commitment to that definitely with this local, and I think that's really important. So I actually see a lot of similarities in that way. You know, when I was at Trent, our local had been around for a while, but it was in a rejuvenation period, which is a period of renewal. And when you have a new local here, it's very similar, that period of renewal. And there's actually people get scared when a local's new. They think, how are we going to do this? How are we going to get this local going? But really, that's the most exciting time because that's the time to go out and talk to members and educate. We can educate ourselves on how important a union is and what it does, right?
Even though you're, as you say, have been here for just a short period of time, what about the comparison between the Trent student body at large, mainly undergrads, and Queen's? What sort of differences do you see there?
Well, I'll bring out the reputation, certainly. Before I got here, I heard a reputation that the undergraduate students here would be sort of less activist-oriented, less oriented toward, you know, labor unions. But I haven't seen that yet. Quite honest, I've only seen kind of good things. I've seen students that have responded well to social justice issues and to issues of labor. And, that might change. There's a large group of students like this, you know, it's varied. People have varied opinions on labor. But so far, I've seen a pretty good, I would say a pretty good, students have pretty good opinions of activism and labor. But when you're a union, you're always going to deal with propaganda that comes out against, and there's always a push-pull relationship between certain student groups and the administration and labor. So we'll see how that pans out, and my opinions might change over time. I don't know.
So you've come to a brand new union here at Queen's. What sort of advice would you bring from your experience at Trent to the brand new TATF union?
I don't know what kind of advice I can give. Main thing is just keep your ears open. I mean, that's always been my philosophy in unionism, particularly when I was in executive positions, is listen. You got to listen. And, you know, a lot of people, particularly in the union sort of union world, we get attacked a lot because the media has a right-wing bias and the government generally has had an attack on labor unions, no matter conservative, liberal, whatever. You know, they have a sort of friction with unions no matter what. And so we get attacked. And so often we think it's hard to resist the temptation to push back real hard. But at the same time with our members, what we got to do is maintain a sense of humility, I think. And the only advice I would give to any labor union at any time, whether it's here or elsewhere, is to try and maintain that humility and respect for members and listen. Because the more we listen, the more we learn, and the more we can organize better.
Have you learned anything from PSAC 901 in your short time here that you'd want to relay to your former union at Trent?
Good question. Yeah. Wow. I wish I'd thought of this before. I could probably think of something better, but... yeah, one of the things that I found really effective when I first got here was the introductory week, the way in which the local here was able to reach out to members. I went to a couple of workshops, one in particular that had some exercises with the collective agreement, getting to know the collective agreement, because these documents, you know, that govern our rights, they're not the most readable documents, but I think... the local here did a great job at getting people involved, doing some exercises on how to read it, what it means, what it is. And I think that I know in my past, maybe I haven't done as good a job when I was back at Trent. They might be doing different things differently now, but I think we could learn from that, those introductory week workshops and getting people in right away to look at the documents that they need so they can fight for their rights when they're being when their rights are being abused by an employer.
Thanks, John.
That's all the time we have this week. Find Rank and File Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Email us at rankandfileradio@gmail.com if you have news for us to cover. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Come all you good workers, good news to you loud out. How the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Directions Aboriginal Student Center, located at 146 Berry Street, offers resources and services for Aboriginal students at Queen's University. Among its many services, the center offers a Three Sisters Feast weekly on Wednesdays from 5 to 7 p.m. at the center, prepared by staff or a guest chef. The center is open daily, Monday to Friday, and hosts events throughout the year. For more information, visit queensu.ca/fdasc.
Two out of three geese. Six out of seven seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl. All agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you. From Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Your thumb on the pulse of global issues. Tune into Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, heard right here on CFRC 101.9 FM on weekdays from noon to 1 p.m. and rebroadcast again weekdays at 7 a.m. Democracy Now! Provides their audience with access to people and perspectives rarely heard in the U.S. corporate-sponsored media. Tune in or check them out online at democracynow.org.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!